welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayen Dengbuer in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, October 28th, 2019. Civil society activists are demanding a probe on pre-oil sales to be released.
I think it's now becoming clear that the delay of this process is a clear indication that there is no political will even to ensure that the process is transparent.
And a religious leader in South Sudan urges the parties to work together so a unity government can be formed soon.
We do not want our leaders to take us back to war. If they think that it is fit to form the government on 12 November, let there be an inclusive government.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Civil society activists in South Sudan are calling on a committee put together by President Salva Kiir last June to look into pre-sale oil deals to release their findings. Activists say the delay in releasing the committee's report shows a lack of political will to fight graft in the country's oil sector. The committee was supposed to produce a report within 2 weeks. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Wani Michael, executive director of the OK Africa Foundation, says he does not understand why it is taking the committee months to make public what it has learned about South Sudan's oil industry.
I think it's now becoming clear that the delay of this process is a clear indication that there is no political will even to ensure that the process is transparent. You know, so it literally means that they want to play some tactics maybe to ensure that citizens don't now bother themselves to know about even the report itself.
Michael says the delay shows the government is reluctant to be transparent about the inner workings of the petroleum sector, which accounts for more than 90% of the country's revenue. Civil society activist Koma Vance of the Peace and Development Collaborative Organization says the South Sudanese people have a right to know what happens in the petroleum sector.
The message going to the public is government is condoning impunity, resources are wasted, individuals waste resources, and services are not delivered, and people are suffering. And these resources that as opposed to self-purpose.
Michael says Petroleum Minister Awau Daniel Chuang, chairperson of the investigative committee, should release the committee's report immediately.
They should be able to make it public, and we're also calling on the president to act on this report, because we have seen a lot of investigation reports and nothing is done to them. Just is going to be a process that is just to normalize things, but we wanted actions taken on this.
Vance says releasing the report will boost the public's confidence in their government.
That the government is working, the government is fighting corruption. And if they are quiet up to now and nothing is done, it's very common. It's a common knowledge in South Sudan. Once a committee is formed, and it's the same way an agenda at hand, corruption at hand is killed. We want such practice to stop.
Presidential spokesman Atteni Wek Atteni told the South Sudan in Focus last June the committee was tasked with investigating oil-related correspondence and agreements signed by the Ministry of Petroleum and the Ministry of Finance. Asked why the findings were taking so long to be released, Petroleum Minister Chuang had this to say.
This one is an investigation report that will be given to the heads of state because it was demanded by the head of state. So it's not for anyone to ask the delays or whatever. Because there are challenges that always face people in terms of the work being done.
Chuang says the report is, in his words, going to be concluded, but did not say when that would be. Activists say the delay in disclosing the committee's findings sends a negative message to the public. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The The Episcopal Church of South Sudan is urging signatories to the revitalized peace deal to talk to each other and reach a consensus on whether to delay or form a unity government next month. The Archbishop of South Sudan's Episcopal Church says the church is concerned about several uncoordinated position papers coming from various parties regarding what to do about the looming November 12th deadline. Winnie Torino has this report for VOA from Juba.
Justin Buddy Arama, Archbishop and Primate of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, says as time winds down on the deadline to form a unity government, the country's leaders should bear in mind the continuous suffering of its citizens.
We do not want our leaders to take us back to war. If they think that it is fit to form the government on 12 November, let there be an inclusive government. And if they think that it is not possible because some of the metrics are not yet implemented, let them agree together and continue to dialogue until they see that all are in place.
Arama says security arrangements as well as the number of states and their boundaries should not be an obstacle to forming a unity government so long as political leaders agree on the way forward.
Everything is in their control. The trainings, the boundaries and everything, it is in their hands. That's why we are saying we need peace. So it is they, if they think the forces can be brought together, trained, it is in their hand. If they say we will continue to train them as we go on, it is in their hand. So our concern is we need peace and stability.
Arama, who was recently elected chairman of the Global South Churches, says he has spoken to other church leaders about the stalemate over whether to form a unity government in South Sudan next month.
I shared with them the current challenge we are in and the crossroads that we are now in, that they should pray for us because we do not know on November 12th whether we shall have a new government in place or not. And if no new government, we need prayers that will enable us after November 12th to guide our leaders to do things which will bring a concrete and peaceful conclusion for the future of this nation.
Arama is urging the parties to implement the revitalized peace agreement in letter and spirit. He says the Episcopal Church will continue to pray for the leaders so that the Spirit of God guides them to do the right thing. For VOA News, I am Muni Serena in Juba.
The executive director of the UN World Food Program has wrapped up a visit to Sudan after helicoptering into the volatile South Kordofan region last week to assess humanitarian needs. In part two of our interview, WFP Chief David Beasley says the trip came about after he sat down with the leaders of Sudan, the SPLM North and South Sudan, and received commitments from all of them to allow workers unfettered access to parts of Sudan for the first time in 8 years.
There's some food needs. There's healthcare needs, and there's definitely educational needs. And I think we can work with these leaders and the people in this community. They don't want handouts. This is what's really quite remarkable. They don't want handouts. They want us to help them so they become self-sufficient. And you can see it in their spirit. You can see how they've been trying to survive during these years. But more importantly, is going to be healthcare needs and education for the children. That's what they want more than anything.
Now, I know you don't have it all worked out, but can you give me a basic timeline of how you plan to roll those things out?
Well, we are literally sitting down discussing with all options right now. That means cross-border operations, cross-line operations. We've already received tremendous cooperation from the South, from South Sudan. And so that's been extremely instrumental in what we're talking about.
And when you say you've gotten their permission and you've gotten their, you know, blessing, does that mean that you plan to go from Juba into Kauta and other places in and around Nuba Mountains?
Well, we will be evaluating all those options as we speak, and we will be looking to access these areas from all different directions. What's going to be the most cost-effective modality and methodology? We'll be looking at that. We'll be evaluating that with all the people involved and explaining these are the routes that we think are necessary, depending upon which side or where where people may be. So all options are on the table. And I'm very hopeful that there will be very few impediments from the governmental perspective, from the political side. At this stage, I'm extremely hopeful.
You know, and speaking of the political side, do you see this as not just a foray into Sudan, areas that you haven't been to in a long time, but also just the general political atmosphere of being much more open now to accomplishing other things?
Well, there's no doubt in Sudan, meeting with the government in Sudan, there's a much more openness and collaborative spirit than we've ever seen before. And I had extensive conversations with Hamdok Berhan and Hameti, and I think it's extremely important because you really can't get anything done without all three of these leaders being on the same page. And we had detailed conversations about different areas of the country. In fact, it was quite remarkable that Hameti himself said we're concerned about the flooding in the Blue Nile. And of course, the Blue Nile is where he has what would be referred to his opposition. And he said, we're concerned about that. Would you please go down there and let us know what you need? And I was like, I almost fell off my chair. I just said, wow, this is fantastic. And I said, now we're gonna need a lot of help from you in a lot of different ways. And I said, can I count on you that when we run into any impediment, bureaucratic or otherwise, that you will be able to address the needs and concerns so that we can deliver humanitarian aid without interference in a neutral manner? And he said, absolutely. So far, so good, and that's Sudan, so I can tell you. Now, we're very concerned about the future for obvious reasons because the economy is deteriorating, and we've got to be there for all the people in a safety net perspective as this economy is going to need some jump-starting and what's going to take place there, but that's in the political side and countries around the world.
Do you plan to go after? Are you going to address Darfur and Blue Nile and those areas?
Yes, we will be talking not just about the Nuba Mountain area, but as well as the Blue Nile, Darfur, and any area there's humanitarian need during this transitional time period. And I'll be meeting with donors to discuss how significant these issues are. We see the food security situation deteriorating over the next 6 months because of the collapse of the economy, and it's going to need outside international support in a most serious way.
That was World Food Program Executive Director David Beasley speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam Friday about his trip to South Kordofan, Sudan, and his meeting with the political leaders of Sudan, South Sudan, and the SPLM North to make his visit a reality. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The Tanzanian government has been accused of abusing the rights of journalists. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your biggest regret?
There was a time I beat up my son to the level that he cannot even stand up. So I really pity him, and then I regretted what I did, honestly. And then since then, I have never tried again.
My biggest regret is when I lost my first wife in 2015, 12 June. But thank God, God has given me another beautiful wife.
I don't have any regret. I've actually tuned myself to know that everything that happens in life is for a purpose.
I can't say I've got a biggest regret, but it's all about challenges. I was able to learn from it and manage it so that everything will go smoothly.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. A new report from two prominent human rights groups says the Tanzanian government is abusing the rights of journalists and opposition parties. The report released today shows the East African nation has adopted repressive laws that restrict the activities of the media, non-governmental organizations, and opposition groups. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports.
In a joint press conference in Nairobi, representatives of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch said Tanzania's government, led by President John Magufuli, has oppressed voices critical to his administration since taking power in 2015. Amnesty International Tanzania's researcher Roland Ebole said they spoke to 68 people for the report and found reams of documentary evidence to back up the accusations.
We got charge sheets in cases of those who had been arrested or presented or charged by the police. We obtained court judgments, court decisions or court documents by those who were arraigned in court. We obtained photographic and video evidence by those who alleged different forms of violations.
President Magufuli came to power in November 2015 with a promise to fight corruption. He was known for shutting down companies and firing government workers without due process. Once in office, he moved to shut down anyone who challenges authority. In 2016, legislators approved a Magufuli-backed law that gives security agencies the power to search media organizations, seize their equipment, and close them without a court order. In 2017, the government closed down two newspapers it accused of inciting violence and has since revoked licenses of three more media organizations. Muthoki Mumo of the Committee to Protect Journalists says the government cannot root out corruption while oppressing journalists, who are often the ones who report on officials' misdeeds.
He came to power with an aggressive anti-corruption agenda. But the question that comes up again and again when we do this research is, how do you expect to implement this? Or how do you expect to achieve these goals if there's no free press?
Mumo was also arrested in Tanzania in 2018. According to the rights groups, the government has also banned the gatherings of opposition politicians and prosecuted some politicians on fabricated charges. Human Rights Watch Africa researcher Oriam Nyeko calls on the Tanzanian government to open up the political space so that the country can conduct upcoming elections.
The findings that we have that media and civil society are effectively silenced does not create a good environment for free and fair elections. So we are encouraging and urging the government to ease these restrictions on civil society and the media, to amend the restrictive laws.
VOA contacted a Tanzanian government spokesman for comment on this story, but calls went unanswered. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
25 years after the genocide perpetrated against the Tutsi, Rwanda is not only still trying to track down some of the perpetrators, but is also struggling to implement court decisions for survivors seeking reimbursement for damaged or stolen property. The Rwanda National Commission for Unity says this impedes reconciliation programs. Eugene Uwimana has more details for VOA from Kigali.
The Ministry of Justice says more than 50,000 court decisions are yet to be implemented to render justice for genocide survivors whose properties were tortured during Rwanda's genocide. Fide Ndayisaba is the Executive Secretary of the National Commission for Unity and Reconciliation. He calls the problem the breaks in the reconciliation journey. When you look at obstacles in our reconciliation journey, the problem of unpaid, damaged or stolen properties comes at the front of it. That's why we're urging responsible stakeholders to solve this problem quickly. To delay means to keep hatred amongst Rwandans. The perpetrators are growing old now. If you wait to shift claims to their children, the burden will grow bigger. Dusingiza Mungu Jean-Pierre is the president of Ibuka, an umbrella organization of genocide survivors. He claims bailiffs and some other institutions have been very negligent. We don't understand why this problem has not been totally solved. I hope this is due to the lack of will of local leaders. who don't want to finish the matter. Rules and regulations on how to implement are clear, but arriving down in the local administration, they hit a deadlock. The problem is being scrutinized by the Elders Advisory Council, which we advise the government on the best ways to close the book on the genocide's transgenerational consequences. Mukana Bana Maria is the council's vice chairperson. She says the advice we'll be giving is of setting up plans to finish these cases very urgently. There are many ways, including that of going down in villages and bringing together survivors and perpetrators to talk about solutions. The government needs to highlight this problem as an emergency, but the Minister of Justice says it's not easy, as some perpetrators have died or fled the country, leaving no property behind, while others are very poor. There are no accurate figures detailing the genocide's economic impact, but the World Bank estimates the tragedy caused a 58% decrease in GDP in 1994. More than 1 million lives were taken in just 100 days. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
We turn to South Africa now, where Parliament debates the National Health Insurance Bill next month. It's a plan for universal health care that proponents say will bring justice and inequality to the healthcare system in this deeply unequal country. But critics say the plan is too ambitious, and they doubt the government, which repeatedly has been accused of corruption in other public sector projects, can do it honestly. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa is one of the most unequal societies in the world. According to the government, only 15% of South Africans have health insurance. The rest falls to the nation's overburdened public health care system. But the government is debating a bill to provide universal coverage, an ambitious plan that they've tested at several public hospitals already. Public hearings begin later this month for the National Health Insurance Bill. Dr. Bundile Masuku, an official in the nation's most populous province, Gauteng, says a national health scheme, in the spirit of Britain's NHS, is a moral necessity.
In a country like South Africa, we are a country of democracy that has to look after the vulnerable. And the universal health coverage is one way that we're going to do it.
Critics point to the government's track record of corruption and mismanagement and say the plan is too ambitious, too expensive, and too vague. Johan Serfontein is an analyst at the health division of the Free Market Foundation.
We've been at it for 10 years. We don't have enough clarity on how we want to do things now. To think that in the next 7 years you're suddenly going to miraculously have that clarity, you know, it's just not a realistic proposal.
But for the chronic care patients like 25-year-old Kanyisa Ntombini, anything is better than the current system. She's had numerous surgeries in public hospitals for her ailments, which include blindness. And she says public hospitals need all the help they can get so the country can develop.
As a country, we will never be able to improve because we have this huge number of people who are unproductive and will forever be sick. So we need the NHI to implement it so that we have more funding in rural hospitals and township hospitals so that people's health can improve.
Tombini says she's willing to subsidize the system.
I think quality health care, like food, like shelter, is something that everybody deserves to have. You know, and for me, I would be more than willing to contribute to ensuring that everybody has a quality health care.
If the bill passes, the system would be implemented by 2026. By then, Tombini would probably be working as an engineer, earning too much to qualify for public health care. And that, she says, is the point. This plan, she says, is for the next generation of South Africans. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria.
From South Africa, we go to Ghana, where the University of Ghana has been in the spotlight this month after an investigation by a BBC program alleged that teachers sexually harass students and, in some cases, demand sex for good grades. Activists say sexual exploitation at the university is not new, but hope attention to the scandal will inspire more victims to speak out. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
The University of Ghana is looking into the allegations against staff in the BBC investigation, which found teachers harassing would-be students. The Sex for Grades documentary showed university lecturers at both the University of Ghana and the University of Lagos propositioning female reporters who were posing as students. Ghanaian activist Eugenia Barfour contributed research to the investigation. She says abusers often operate with a sense of impunity. However, she says the fallout is causing more victims to speak out.
Something good has already come out, even for the number of stories that came out, the kind of courage and strength they gave a lot of victims and survivors to speak out about their abusers was a huge step for us in the right direction when it comes to not being silenced anymore as a victim.
As first reported by the BBC, there are increasing allegations of sexual harassment by teachers at West African universities. The University of Ghana's Anti-Sexual Harassment Committee is investigating two of the accused, who have both denied the allegations. The committee head, Margaret Amakwaheni, says they are intensifying the outreach but need student victims to come forward.
All we ask of them is that don't endure any humiliation, don't endure any harassment. Let us take that responsibility. And once you inform us, you are virtually saying, I'm offloading this burden on you, take it up. And we shall do that. But if you don't tell us and you keep it to yourself, you are emboldening the perpetrator.
The University Student Representative Council Women's Commissioner says that while the allegations of Sex for Grades are disturbing, they are not new. She hopes the scandal will bring awareness to students who were not familiar with the university's policy that they can and should report harassment.
We feel over the year there hasn't been the enabling environment for victims to approach the SRC and address or inform them about these malpractices or these mishappenings that are going on. So we are creating the enabling environment. So it's like a peer-to-peer group.
Meanwhile, the Student Council is launching a campaign to support victims of sexual harassment and also want to educate teachers about inappropriate behaviour with students. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
That's our show for this Monday. We leave you with a newer song by Gomang. We've been listening to Gomang with the newer song. I'm Carol. I'm Ayan Dengbior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Thank you.
Tengmeral mete durukulo bigurnyalda